You are listening to Investing Matters, brought to you in association with London South East. This is the show that provides informative, educational, and entertaining content from the world of investing. We do not give advice, so please do your own research.
Hello, and welcome to this Investing Matters podcast. My name is Peter Higgins, and you can find me at Conquest3 on Twitter. And I'm here with Mike McCudden, CEO of Infinitex.
Hi, Peter.
We're going to be talking about the platform, what it does, how it does it, why it's important for capital markets and private investors, startups and entrepreneurs. Mike's got a fantastic history. I'm going to delve into that a little bit as well. But first, hello, Mike. How are you doing?
Good, thank you. Happy Friday. Sun is shining here in Glasgow. Good to speak to you.
Good to speak to you from Glasgow. Mike, I want to start this interview because you've got a fantastic history, which I want to delve into a little bit. I want to start first with your first job, having graduated, because you did a degree in risk management.
Yeah.
And that seems to be a thread throughout this conversation. And I wanted to start there. Please share with us the background behind that. Why risk management, what it led to, and then your first job.
I think because at uni, nobody else would take me, and that was the one that was available.
Great start.
I studied risk management, and I guess through that, I kind of developed, I suppose, what age was it, 18, 19? I developed an interest in financial risk management, which made me into capital markets and down that rabbit hole, and I'm still down there somewhere at the moment. So that was my journey into risk management back at Glasgow Caledonian Uni. We shout out for my alma mater there.
Brilliant. Now, I'm not sure if it was your first job or not, but Aitken Campbell and Co, senior market maker. Now, everyone's got these different ideas about what a market maker is. You went in there and you also became a senior market maker.
Yeah, yeah.
So just you know, cancel out some myths, but also tell us a little bit about what a market maker does, please.
Well, I mean, I don't want to forget about McDonald's. I mean, I was there for a few years as well, learned a lot. But yeah, I gave up McDonald's and went into the market making game. Actually, after I'd planned to leave uni, I had a summer internship with a company called West LB Panmure. So I was thrust onto the trading floor there, and I found it a very eye-opening experience. And then after uni, an opportunity came up for a firm that I'd actually never heard of called Aitken Campbell and Company. And it was one of the old market makers, actually originally affiliated with the Scottish Stock Exchange, which was in Glasgow at that point. It was a 100-year-old business. You know, it was around for a long time. And I went into that pretty eyes open, not really sure what a market maker or a stock jobber was or any of the other terms that are used for it. So, I get a job in there. I think they were paying me about 11 grand a year. And it was basically T-boy assisting the market makers. And I just loved the cut and thrust of it, the environment, the risk, the stress, the everything really about managing all this order flow that was coming through from brokers and various other, you know, intermediaries and whatnot. And you're there making the price. And very quickly, I kind of got to grips with it. I then, you know, got my first book, as they call it. So I managed, what did I manage again? Miners to breweries to, you know, telcos to, there was a whole book of business, probably about 50 stocks, right? So the job of the market maker, really a competing market maker at that point, we were all plugged into the London Stock Exchange, was to compete on the bid offer spread with other market makers. There was another 15, 20 or so around at that time, all varying different sizes. And, you know, we were a main full-size market maker, as they're called. And you had to make a price. You're a bookie, essentially. So you follow these stocks, you get to know them intimately. You understand the behaviors of the other market makers. And, you know, you're there primarily as a group to provide a price, provide liquidity. to make sure the market works. And that is the regime we've been operating in the UK for forever, really. I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I was there for 6-7 years. We were bought out in 2001, probably 2 years into it, by a consortium led by Charles Schwab and TD Bank. And we became their kind of UK market maker. So yeah, no, we were a big player, really enjoyed it, loved the risk. And I think market making then was a little bit different to what it is now. But yeah, I certainly loved it. I loved it. Best job ever, as we always say.
Best job ever. So can you just quell some of the myths about what a market maker can and can't do, though? Because there's certain institutions out there, fund managers even, and even obviously retail investors, have got this thing about, oh, market makers have done this to my stock and da-da-da, just complete nonsense.
Yeah, I mean, well, no idea where that comes from, really. Market makers have done this to my stock. You're probably talking to maybe a CFD spread bet trader or something. that can be quite different.
Yes. Yes.
Because certain companies will make their own market, which is away from, they're not a market maker. So they'll make their own price. And maybe they're complaining about that. I don't know, but certainly market making, since I was around, so pre-2008, actually, really, you know, firms, jobbers, market makers, whatever, would take on a lot of risk and supply of a lot of liquidity. So we had something called the back book, and you would run pretty large positions. Nowadays, as far as I'm aware, but, you know, so I'm sure somebody out there will correct me if I'm wrong, there's not as much risk taken on. And that's certainly been mandated through a lot of the banks that have market-making divisions. So so I can understand it's probably a little bit more volatility. The spreads are probably a little bit wider. But certainly, back in my day, I had to be on point for a price. So if my phone went off, it was either another competing market maker who had a large order to fulfill at a set price. That was between him and his client. And you've kind of got a wee bit of second guessing at that point. So you might get a phone call from Goldman Sachs, whoever, say, right, what's your price in size in a particular company? Which means that there is a kind of normal market size that you'd quote up to if you're a full-size market maker, but then they'd phone you up and want something a lot larger. So you've got to think about, well, actually, what have I got in my back book? What is the overall risk position of the firm? You've got to take all these things into consideration in about 4 seconds, give the guy an answer, see where you make his price, do a bit of negotiating.
Yep.
And then you'll see the market adjust accordingly, because he's not just phoning me, he's phoning everybody else, you know? So there's a bit of that. And I just loved that because, you know, every day was completely different. You didn't know what you were going to hit with. You didn't, you know, you could be sitting with a large amount of stock in a particular company and some really good news or alternatively some really bad news might come out in that particular company. It could be a profits warning pre-market or something. And you go in and you go, oh dear, that position I've got, I'm holding a few million shares, has just dropped 25%. Gonna have to do something about that. So, you know, things like that where certainly continued to spark my interest. And I worked with a bunch of great people and, you know, we had a good laugh and it was stressful. It was, you know, it had everything you would want. And I went from kind of shy little boy, came out of university, to somebody who was broken and rebuilt, I guess. by your colleagues, you know. And you know what? I was good at it. So I rose through the ranks fairly quickly and to a senior market maker position. So I had a bunch of other market makers reporting into me. So I'm managing the risk across areas of the firm and, you know, all of that stuff. So it was really, really, really good fun. And I look, I've stayed in the industry ever since. And I still speak to my old colleagues. I still speak to the people I would trade with and against. That you'd be shouting at 1 minute over the phone, calling them all sorts, and then meeting for a pint in the pub after. You know, it's that kind of environment. There's a lot of camaraderie.
Brilliant.
And I loved it. Absolutely loved it.
Thank you. I love that response. Thank you ever so much for giving me that full response. I really appreciate it. Now, from there, you know, you said that you got consumed by Charles Schwab, TD, etc.
You moved on from
that role to CMC Markets as regional head of Scotland, IG Institutional Sales, And then, you know, interactive investor as head of product. Please, can you share with us your accumulated greatest lessons from those significant roles that you held?
Oh, I certainly learned a lot, you know, because you move from basically a market maker to, you know, a position within, for example, CFC Markets, where you're like, right, you're now regional head of Scotland, go get an office, set up a team, sell a product. And again, I like things that challenge me. You know, I guess I got that job with my markets experience and fairly at that time, I guess, fairly limited knowledge on what, you know, leverage trading was and what are all these things, CFDs, spread betting. And CMC Markets was a real game changer at the time. I think they'd gone from deal for free or whatever in the early noughties to become CMC. And they're now a major, major company, you know, led by Peter Cruddas and a great team, you know, still a formidable player. And from there into IG. So you know, I learned a lot about different company dynamics. You know, I went from a small company, really, I know we were owned by Charles Schwab TD, who are massive, but on all intents and purposes, we've got a small team, to working for big companies, you know, big agendas and big teams and various layers of hierarchy and stuff. So that was, for me, a great learning curve. You know, you know, managing my remit and reporting into London, and you know, just all of that was you can understand, anyone listening to this will understand the dynamic change, the politics and everything else that comes with it. And I thoroughly enjoyed my time there before I moved into IG, which again was an even bigger player, still are, massive global company. And you know, they were absolutely smashing out of the park, you know, at that time. I believe they still are. And, you know, I thought, great change, another product provider. They wanted me to do something slightly different, which is more focus on institutional relationship management. That basically involves other institutions with large client bases, white labeling or gray labeling or product and whatnot there. So again, different toolkit, different face on, you know, different client community and everything else. But this was all removed from Mike making a price in Marks and Spencer or whatever. Quite different.
Yes.
There was none of that. It was more kind of sales, team development, you know, building a brand role. So you learn a lot around product, marketing, your client behaviors, big corporate strategy, you know, all, you know, managing your P&L for your firm and hiring and firing and all that jazz, you know, that I'd not really done before. kind of thrust me into that light. So yeah, no, I enjoyed that. And with my, I guess with the kind of product side, that led me into, you know, I had a great opportunity came along really to join Interactive Investor at that point. And again, Interactive when I joined was a beast, but been through a few changes. It was a large kind of financial information website. They had a relationship with a third party, a Halifax share dealing, for all the share dealing needs. And then around the time I came along, you know, some of the guys were like, right, we're going to bring this in-house. So they built the whole kind of end-to-end broking business in Glasgow here, where I am. So it was a good fit because I could operate out of Glasgow with my product hat on and, you know, watch this massive project underway, you know, where they're basically building their own share dealing service, migrating hundreds of thousands of customers over into this new way of doing things, and you know, watching that grow. So that, again, that was just to be around, that was a great opportunity and a great experience. And I again was more focused on, you know, product, what clients want, market trends. What do people trade in? You know, I would manage a lot more of the more specialist products around, whether it be derivatives trading, because obviously I'd just come out of IG, through to structured products, futures and options, you know, all these, you know, do our clients want it? You know, how do we use our products to attract more high net worth, you know, sophisticated investors? How do we increase our AUA? all of that, you know, was, you know, close to my heart at the time. And at the same time, in parallel to that, you know, I would be a spokesman for Interactive Investor on, you know, day-to-day market moves, what investors were doing. And I loved it, you know, it was fascinating, you know, because instead of getting back to being a market maker, you're actually looking at, okay, what motivates retail investors, you know, with their pension holdings and all that kind of stuff, which I didn't really understand until that point. You know, ISA season, all these things, you know, that were all kind of over there, all of a sudden kind of landed in my lap. So it was around product, knowing the market, working with, you know, we're a large, you know, marketing division. We had our own kind of, you know, we had a couple of financial information news brands and whatnot. So it was a fascinating business, and still is, you know, and they were recently acquired by Aberdeen for $1.5 billion or something. So, you know, I'd gone well before that, but around 2017-18. And they're still powering ahead as, you know, one of the biggest, you know, online brokers in the UK. And I watched a lot of that journey happen on our watch, and it was a great team.
Brilliant. So having covered all of that from being a market maker and having done risk management as a degree, the only thing that's not in your portfolio at this point in time regarding your work,
McDonald's,
is you've done McDonald's as well. Yes,
second best job actually was McDonald's.
you've not been really involved with privately held companies per se. So you're now looking at this, and the idea comes up. How does the idea come up in the first place regarding formerly CrowdX, now Infinitex?
Yeah.
You know, who were you sitting down with? What were your thought processes? What was the market you were looking at thinking, that's an untapped market there, let's sort that out? What happened, Mike?
Well, it's a kind of long story, actually. So I'm not the founder of Infinitex. So we are a pure technology company. So I've been around the technology and the guys that build the technology and everything else, like, my whole career. And I remember even in my market making days, there was a few startups like ScottX, which was around trading in match bargains and private companies. You know, I'd be looking over the hedge going, what do they do? And what do they do that's different from what I do? So I was all public market stuff. And, you know, liquidity has always been a major talking point throughout my entire career. And I remember even in the 90s, well, I started in 98, 99, but, you know, I was aware of the likes of JP Jenkins and their transition into OFX and the explosion around .com and their journey becoming, you know, ISDX, Michael Spencer, then NEX, and now ultimately Aquis Exchange in London, you know, through various iterations and different licenses and whatnot. But I was always interested in, okay, well, how did they do that? How did they unlock liquidity in private companies without them being public? I didn't know. now I do, obviously. So that's always been there. And then I'd been introduced by a good friend of mine to a chap called Andrew Foster, a South African native living in London, who had built, who had, you know, strong technology background. And he had a few guys with him that he introduced me to. Now my CTO, Derek. And these guys have been in and around this technology space for their entire careers and supported other public markets, private markets, and everything else, you know, and actually writing, coding the technology that powers this stuff. So, I mean, I met with Andrew and we got on my house and fire. Great, great guy, everything else. And he's like, well, okay, well, I've got this over here. This isn't my day job. Do you think you can do something with it? You know, we've built technology which powers private markets, excuse me. And I was aware of, you know, guys in the US like CartaX and Forge and, you know, NASDAQ private markets. And so obviously I got my fingertips going on Google at that point. so I could do much more work. And you could see the the size of these markets, and especially the US. And okay, why is there more liquidity? Why is there more, you know, private transactions going on over there? Then understanding more about the corporate culture over there, employees, share ownership, all these things. And then looking at the UK and looking at the number of players like from cap table management solutions, like, you know, Vested and, you know, Seed Legals, and then the registrar community and whatnot. And okay, well, how do we use technology over here to drive liquidity like they're doing over there? You know, nobody's really cracked it. So with our technology, we knew we were able to crack it, because the way things were done traditionally was very manual, very over the phone, Excel spreadsheets and all the rest of it. Whereas we can actually add in a layer of technology that can plug in to the market and offer that match bargain trading solution to ultimately a wider audience. So, and sell that tech globally. So as a global tech player, obviously my background crosses trading financial markets to selling tech to other parties. You know, I thought, well, actually now is a really, really timely opportunity to get thoroughly involved in this space. And yeah, no, I jumped at the opportunity. I'm not gonna lie to you. You know, it was really exciting, really interesting bunch of people. It was right in the middle of COVID and the pandemic. So interestingly, I mean, I didn't meet Andrew until about 6 months after taking the job as chief exec. And by that point, I can go on about the journey to where we are today in a minute. But you know, it was very exciting, because you were in a strange global pandemic situation. I had a box of tricks. We needed to formalize a company, get it financed, go through the regulatory hurdles, get our governance in place, you know, get it financed, get it moving, bring in the support and the team that I needed around me, and went on that journey. And here I am a couple of years later. We've just acquired JP Jenkins. You know, we're going from strength to strength. So, yeah, I've been really happy with the journey thus far. And allow me to continue.
Brilliant. You just touched on it there a little bit. I want you to expand on it. In January of this year, you purchased JP Jenkins, the most recognised brand in the UK secondary market space for private companies.
Yeah.
What were the drivers for that acquisition, Mike? And what does it mean for embedding the fintech technology of Infinitex with JP Jenkins, please?
I think when the opportunity came along, it was more around optics. Just when, you know, it came to me, there might be an opportunity to look at a business. And obviously I knew who JP Jenkins were. And we thought, well, as a technology company, we know JP Jenkins runs a fairly traditional non-tech-led model. It's the most recognised brand in the space in the UK. What if we plugged in our technology? Would allow us to showcase the technology that we're powered by CrowdX, which now became Infinitex. And how do we do that? And, you know, in principle, it was a nice idea. But then I met the team. And, you know, I'm more interested in people than I'm in products. So I met the guys who were running JP Jenkins day to day. And we loved them. We just loved the ambition. They could see what we could bring to them, which is really important. And you know, they got the value add. They were buying into the global dynamics of what we can do here. And you know, after, you know, a few months of, you know, the usual due diligence, lawyers and all the rest of it, you know, we came to an agreement for an all share, you know, acquisition of the business, and lock, stock and barrel. Just moved them into new premises, and, you know, we're getting them motoring, and we're doing great. You know, we're absolutely loving it. You know, so we want to obviously build out that team. It's now given us a presence in London, which is still very important in this business. So London's become more kind of front office, client relationship management. Glasgow, where I'm sat today, although I kind of switched between the two, is more kind of back office ops, if you want to call it that. And you know, we've just gone through the journey of linking everything up and doing all the fun stuff to get the business motoring. And yeah, so it's working out really well. Couldn't be happier with the team. We're about to, I mean, if you go on the, you know, websites and what right now, we're doing a lot of overhaul on the brand and the service layers and the team, and everything's watch this space coming soon. And we're working with, you know, a number of, shall we call them, financial intermediaries in the space as well. So yeah, we've got lots of good stuff happening, and we're very excited about what the future holds for the JPJ brand as we build that. And then obviously, you know, what we can do internationally and at home with Infinitex and our technology, which is, you know, second to none.
Brilliant. Now, I wanted to touch on, because a lot of people haven't dealt with unlisted companies before.
Yeah.
Can you describe JP Jenkins as a liquidity venue for unlisted assets in the UK?
Yeah.
Which type of assets do you accept?
Like mainly plain
meeting
vanilla.
Your criteria?
Well, it's mainly 95% will be your standard equity in these companies. Yeah. So generally, the businesses that come to us are kind of been around for a wee while. You know, they're kind of pre-Series A, and they've got good governance in place. They probably have audited accounts. They've got grand plans. They want to IPO at some point in the future. They might be under a little bit of pressure from the early stage investors to provide some liquidity and exit. And that is ideally the kind of client that we work with, because through our proposition and service layers and everything else, it's all about enabling and driving and accelerating their path to exit, IPO, whatever they, you know, obviously the clients, they run their own business. We provide a service for them, and it's pretty straightforward, really. You know, client comes to us, we meet them, and they may have an advisor or somebody that they might need some external support. You know, we onboard them, we get them set up in Crest, which is, you know, for transactions, trading, settlement, everything else. We put them onto that system, and yeah, they become tradable through your broker, through your nominee account, and everything else. Different from public. I mean, you can again delve into that area if you like, but you know, there's different dynamics around. Because, you know, most companies will require certainly a shareholder resolution to go through, you know, amends to the articles of the business, preemption rights, everything else. All this all has to be fully analysed, walked through with the client, and then, you know, putting them on that journey one step at a time. So it's not, but yeah, I mean, it's still a lot quicker than if you want to IPO, that could be 2 years and £1 million. You know, this is, we are more of a progression stage for these businesses that are on that journey. And you've seen the other day the LSE are now doing making some announcements around that as well. So there's a lot of interest in this space. Going back to the point, you know, with, you know, I thought it was timely to come in. We're now seeing everybody talking about what we can do in the private space. And now
it's growing absolutely rapidly. I was going to touch on a bit later on about the fact that LSE, London Stock Exchange, made their own investment in Flow last March as well, in that secondary market space.
Yeah.
But I wanted to just keep on, stick to the private market space and the entrepreneurs and the startups.
Yeah.
There's a piece of research recently from Bolhurst, the private company research house.
Yeah.
And they touched on the fact that the rest of the UK saw equity investment fall of 30% last year. You're based in Scotland. Scotland bucked the trend and actually rose by 12.6%.
Yeah.
Mike, do you have any insights into the outperformance of Scotland? And are Infinitex and JP Jenkins going to be taking advantage of those startups and untapped companies within that space? You know, you're there, you've got the, you know, the foothold in Scotland, and everyone knows of you as well, you know, across the country.
Yeah, I mean, obviously I'm a Scot. I'm obviously passionate about, you know, everything Scotland, but you know, we run a UK business. You know, we're my entire career has been so JP, if you're focusing on JP Jenkins, that's primarily UK. And I guess outperformance with regards to deal flow, quality deal flow, investor base. There's actually a very good, strong, albeit small, perfectly formed investment community within Scotland. And they do a lot of deal sharing, working together, everything else. There's lots of really good players in the space up here, like Par Equity, we can talk about them. They're in Edinburgh, various others, Kelvin Capital, Glasgow, Scottish Enterprise has got a brilliant system set up. I think you can identify quality, and there's good support layers within the Scottish ecosystem for not only startups, but companies approaching an SME type size as well, to getting them obviously financed. I mean, that's one of the problems we are trying to address, because again, I mean, you'll hear lots of people talking about this. Back in the good old days, we had 40-odd exchanges in the UK. Companies could go locally to raise capital. You wouldn't have had shipbuilding in the Clyde if it wasn't for, a local market for raising money and all this. But that story's throughout the UK. It's not changed, But since the 70s, it's become very London-centric. And that just means, all of the skills, lots of the skills and expertise around, larger corporate financing, et cetera, all went to the square mile. So you lost a lot of that. And we're trying to, I think collectively, we're all trying to redress that, there's lots of great stuff going on in the north of England, Leeds, Manchester, Liverpool, lots of exciting projects, lots of localized initiatives supporting business. I think Scotland's bucked the trend. Perhaps there could be some outliers there from great opportunities. We have seen some big ones come out of Scotland in recent years from Trustpilot, Skyscanner, and various others. There's been some pretty good plays. So, and we've got a brilliant support network, FinTech Scotland, various others. I mean, there are options for young businesses looking for support. There are plenty of people you can pick up the phone to, talk to, arrange a meeting. I think that's a real strength in Scotland right now, and long may it continue.
Yeah, long may it continue, because as you touched on briefly there, Scotland did have its own exchange for a good while, and it's probably one of the last ones that was left yep. in Scotland.
It was,
before everything got centralised down in London.
Yeah, I mean, it was centralised in Scotland first. We had three or four, Edinburgh, Glasgow, Aberdeen, somewhere else, I'm not sure. They were all centralized to Glasgow to become the Scottish Stock Exchange back in the, in 1973 or something, all before I was born, his dad. And then it was just ultimately swallowed up by London. So Glasgow Scottish Stock Exchange became part of the London Stock Exchange, I guess. And there it is to this day. You've got the powerhouse in London. And it made sense at the time. To do so, definitely because of the lack of technology. You'd have a market maker in Glasgow making a different price from a market maker in Newcastle, and now everything's technology led, electronic. You can get a real time price wherever you are in the world. Doesn't matter where you are. So what we need to rebalance is the support in the pockets of finance available for great businesses, throughout the UK. You shouldn't have to go to London to get financed, is what I'm saying.
Brilliant. No, thank you for that, Clive. Now, I'm going to touch on a piece of research here from Jefferies Research.
Yep.
They recently stated that the investor's portfolio currently allocated to private markets, Mike, globally is 24%. What's the estimated size of the whole private markets globally Infinitex and your company can actually tap into?
Trillion, it's huge. Multi-trillion dollar market. Yeah, it changes with every report you read on it. But look, it's an absolute behemoth, and also with the the transfer of wealth, which is really undertaken right now, and over the next 20 years or so is huge. So there's a lot of what do you call it, dry powder, I think it's a technical term people use for it in the industry. So there is untapped potential there for businesses to receive investment at an earlier stage in bigger size and have much more transparency around those companies to make them more investable. Right now, it's the, you know, it's the remit of, you know, high net worth, sophisticated, really knowledgeable investors that come into this space. But yeah, that is changing with, you know, liquidity, transparency, the ability to exit, you know, better governance, better regulation around the space. You know, that will change dramatically in the years ahead. And I think we're certainly very well positioned to capitalize on that, because we can take our tech pretty much anywhere on the planet we want to go with it. And because it's all about plugging in that ecosystem of players, wherever they may be in the world, you know, within a good quality regulated environment. You know, we've got, you know, there's clients we're working with from Germany to New Zealand right now. The US market is still by far and away the biggest place in the world for this. So we'd obviously like to, we're obviously making moves to get ourselves in there. And that would be largely through licensing or tech or working in a JV relationship with others in the space who are, you know, who are quite evolved. So
you overlooked on two of my questions there. So I'm gonna go back to one.
No problem.
As in, things are, you're actually in a sweet spot here, because the Financial Conduct Authority recently announced a series of initiatives to help secondary market conditions.
Yeah.
What were these initiatives, and did they align with Infinitex's strategic goals, Mike?
Yeah, certainly. I think, you know, there's a lot of consultations going on at the moment still around, certainly they've made it, they're trying to make it easier for companies to list publicly IPO. But I think our argument is, you know, well, actually a lot more can be done in the earlier stages, which is why you reference flow and more involvement from some of the bigger guys in this space with the earlier stage businesses, because there's tens of thousands of businesses that can be ready for private markets, whereas there's tens of businesses which are maybe ready right now for IPO. So, I mean, our argument is we don't want companies to IPO too early. You know, we want companies to go through the journey, generate some liquidity, understand the sensibilities around being public, because that can be a shock to the system, to plenty of CEOs that go from running a great private business to all of a sudden, you know, public company. So there's a whole lot of, you know, more requirements around you as a business. Could be a short. We're that kind of gentle journey into that world. And with the optics around having liquidity, having an electronic price, having, you know, the use of, you know, some of our partners like EQS and whatnot to get that market information out there around your company. It's, you know, driving value for investors, but also having a sensible, steady approach to public markets is where, and look, everybody wants to do that, you know, and I know the FCA are looking at it, LSE have been looking at it, we're all looking at it, but, you know, this is nothing new here. They've been doing this for a long time over in the US. Right now they've got, you know, they've now got NASDAQ private markets. Carta X is going great guns. They were a cap table management solution. Now with the, well, they were Carta, then they became Carta X, and they've now got a good function for companies looking to for a liquidity solution. So, you know, it's still the same old story. You know, we're always 10 years behind what they're doing in the US. So, you know, let's up our game over here. We can do it. The regulator understands that, the players understand that. And, you know, if we all get together and do it right, because look, ultimately we want to look after the underlying business, make sure they're coming on to us at the right price point, the right journey, they get what, you know, they get what it's, what we're here to do for them. And you know, ultimately make their exit or IPO much, well, proof will be in the pudding, but ultimately hopefully make that much more successful. Similarly, some companies have been coming off the main markets, and they still want to, obviously, you know, let's, again, don't forget about the underlying investors, you know, when you provide a solution for them in order to either hold or trade stock from their regular share dealing account. You know, I think that, again, that's where we are. We're in that service space, but we are excited at our book of clients now, also the ones that have been onboarded various different stages, are really exciting companies on the up. You know, they'll join us, they might stay with us for 2 or 3 years, while they're working on other areas. It could be, you know, obviously planning for their IPO, working with a Nomad, whatever else. And they're just making sure that timing's right, you know. When is the best time to IPO? You know, the market changes, as you well know, ups and downs. Right now, it's been a very difficult environment, as we all know, in the UK. So we can hold companies back, you know, on that progressive stage, sit with us, wait for the timing. And again, with my market maker hat on, you know, get the timing right and you'll pop onto the market. Everybody will get involved, the market makers, drive the liquidity and hopefully the price higher. Which is what our clients want. Mm. Investors
absolutely
want.
I'm going to touch on some of the companies that just after this question. I want to get this question in, Mike, because it seems to me that there's a massive, massive market. You touched on the US there, and You've got the behemoth hedge fund Tiger Global is currently seeking options to liquidate $40 billion worth of portfolio. Yeah.
Don't think
in private companies that tap into secondary market. You must be absolutely, your company must be salivating. You know, it appears that, you know, exit strategies are needed for these large behemoths to get into other markets, and you want to be able to match some of that. You know, you must be going, like, come on, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think, you know, Tiger are just one, but, you know, I think, you know, there are any number of, you know, funds from, you know, family offices to ESG funds and everything else around there. Okay, they'll be smaller pots, but, you know, I think with our solution, it's driving that liquidity for these funds as well. So if they want to pair, take some money off the table, they've got company X, you know, they want to reinvest in another opportunity, you know, they can bring that business to us. We can provide that liquidity point for them in the right cordial manner and allow them to perhaps take some money off the table and invest in other opportunities. So it's all about making sure that money flow is there to help support these underlying young growth businesses, which we can't forget are the backbone of our economy, whether you like it or not. You know, it's providing the jobs, creating the ideas. We want to be able to support that network, take a bit of the risk off the table for the budding entrepreneurs that are growing businesses, making sure there's finance available for them. And through the likes of us, we can do a bit for the economy. You know, I mean, there's a reason why, you know, companies have been going to the US to, you know, to list, to raise finance and everything else, because they've got a vastly bigger, let's call it, ecosystem around and support for growing businesses. So people see it as a, you know, as a risk off approach when they see a company going to the States, you know, because they'll be underpinned by a much more liquid investor environment for them to support them through the various trials and tribulations of growing a business.
Yeah, thank you for that reply. Now, I want to touch on some of the current companies and also the fact that one of the most recent delistings, iEnergizer, has been admitted to your share matching platform.
Yeah.
You've got the likes of MJ Hudson, Goodbody Health, Millwall Holdings, Millwall Football Club, Rangers International Football Club, which I'm sure,
well,
you know,
some of your team will probably got.
Yeah, I saw you smile straight away there.
Yeah,
previously,
yeah, yeah.
You've had Arsenal, Liverpool, yeah. Man City, you know, all on the JP Jenkins
platform.
Yeah,
I think some of them are certainly legacy.
Established companies.
Yeah, some of them certainly legacy that might not be trading anymore, but we've got some great businesses that are coming on. Again, iEnergizer and but we are working with obviously a huge portfolio around, you know, 50 or 60 businesses right now that are at different phases of engagement with our firm. The average kind of market size of businesses has increased significantly over the last 6 months since we acquired JP Jenkins. And you know, there's some big ticket, let's call them cornerstone companies coming our way, which obviously we're really excited about. So we're all about quality, showing our clients obviously the service they need. Regardless, we're fairly sector agnostic, but we are layering in other elements to drive transparency, like, you know, ESG reporting, impact reporting, various other factors which will influence an investor's view of a business. So over time, we will try our best to obviously make it much more palatable, transparent, more information on these businesses. That will ultimately drive more liquidity, investment profile, everything around them. So yeah, I think with our book of business, you know, we couldn't be happier with some of the companies that have just joined us, and you know, we'll see where they go.
Thank you for that. Now, there's an important point that I need you to reiterate for the retail investors that haven't used your platform before, with regards to the fact that, you know, you were a previous market maker.
Yeah.
But JP Jenkins and Infinitex don't actually make a market.
No.
Yeah.
No.
You purely match at a price.
Yeah. So it's buying for our retail investors. Seller. Yes. Yes. Yeah, so, I mean, the difference, I mean, you have market makers, obviously, to drive liquidity, stabilize the price and everything else. That's all public markets. We don't have that necessarily in the private space. Certainly not market maker driven. But we can use technology to help support and stabilize as well. So optics around the, from an investor's perspective, you know, they come to us to obviously see the companies that are available on our platform. But it still runs like they would be buying shares on a public market. So we sit in the middle. We have, okay, let's call them gatekeepers. Those gatekeepers are brokers. They would need to reach out to their broker. They would need to be assessed or find a broker. They would need to be assessed for suitability and everything else. And at that point, via their broker, they can then access our venue. So we're not a market from a regulated firm or exchange. We're a match bargain facility, or to use another term, I think we're a bulletin board as well. So, but these companies need to be onboarded. We need to, as I alluded to earlier, we need to make sure that obviously everything's fit and proper about providing and having the approvals in place. We don't do, I mean, there are firms out there that it's specifically in the US and other places that will do, you know, unauthorized share trading, whereas we work directly with the business. Everything's authorized. Everything's approved, and then, you know, they may have they may allow buyers and sellers to agree where to meet. So there is a reference price, a mid price. There's a trading history. You know, they will post a limit order. You know, I want to buy X shares at a certain price, and you know, if we find a seller to match their bid, then off they go. You know, we change his hands, runs through the CREST system. Cash and stock changes hands, and you know, that is how the model works. But because of that layer, it means it's only for the only for investors that, you know, are deemed to really know what they're doing in this space. That will change over time, but right now it's onboarding, suitability, doing it right, and you know, willing buyer meets willing seller, and somebody can sell, obviously somebody can then hold the stock.
Brilliant. Thank you for expanding on that, Mike. I really appreciate it. Now, I want to just have a little break here now. I'm conscious I've had you on for a little while, but I must speak about your own investing strategy, Mike. Where do you invest your money, your diversification? Do you have your own ISA, your own pension? You know, you've been doing this for ages, mate, decades. So you must have something going on there.
Yeah, I am. You know, I've dabbled in very short-term trading, as you can imagine, being in the leveraged spread bet CFD space and everything else.
Yes.
And market making, you know, you can be a rock star when you're trading other people's money, but when it comes to your own, I've had a few disasters. I'm not going to lie about that. I'm more your kind of patient capital, you know, decent yields, only invest in what I understand, you know, and I'm pretty patient. But, you know, I could, you know, I certainly, when I speak to my friends and other people who invest, we couldn't be more different. You know, they expect me to be the super short-term micro FX trader. But no, I don't have time for that because I'm a busy man. You know, I've got a small portfolio mixed with some private and public. And, yeah, I'm pretty happy with it, to be honest. Nice spread of risk. Do your homework, you know. Trade with the trends, not with your friends, as they always say, and stick with it. You know, do your own analysis, research. and make it interesting. You know, I think that's investing in what you know. You know, invest in stuff you're passionate about, you know, areas you're interested in. That could be AI, that could be, you know, environmental, it could be anything really. So, I mean, whatever floats your boat from an investment perspective, do your homework and be careful, you know. Don't put all your eggs in one basket is key to all this.
I love that you touched on the fact of the importance of doing your own research as well, Mike. Thank you for saying that.
Absolutely.
Because so many people will just, you know, FOMO and just chase whatever's going on. Whatever's on trend almost.
No, we were talking about, we had an executive meeting this morning and everybody was just talking about AI for an hour. We didn't really get much work done. You know, it was all about, you know,
it's a massive topic, Mike. I did have it in my questions here, but I figured I'd run out of time. I've got another question after this. Yeah. And it was this. This was going to be my question to you. As a CEO who does a lot of navigating of the tech space, fintech space, the relationship with AI and its efficiencies and cost-saving benefits are great. Yeah. How do you marry that with the potential societal risks and the impacts regarding jobs and other things going on? It's one of those yin and yang sort of discussions, isn't it?
Yeah, I know it's so topical. You know, we're actually laughing about it this morning. Okay, nobody's talking about, you know, NFTs and Web3 right now. That's all last week's story. It's all about AI and how it's going to change the world and take your job and everything else. I think we've all predicted Keynes back in the 30s that predicted the 14-hour working week. It's not exactly materialized, but certainly, look, AI is going to be revolutionary. You know, let's not make no bones around it. And it's certainly going to drive a lot of factors in this space, in our space, in finance and investing, quicker than you know it. We just have to keep an eye. We're not an AI company, but, you know, we work with others that build in that space. Clients are coming on in that space, but it's a real game changer. Hopefully more positives than negatives come out of it, you know. Hopefully can rebalance some of the ills around the world, especially the wealth gap and everything else. Want it to create jobs, create value, make things more efficient, but, you know, less efficiently, you know, get the positives out of it and not drive it towards selling us more stuff we don't need to buy.
Absolutely. Mike, I've got one final question for you. I'm conscious I've had you on for nearly an hour now. You've been exposed to and experienced the financial markets from several different angles over the past few decades. What are the recurring prudent pieces of investment knowledge you would like to share to our global audience of ultra-high net worth individuals, CEOs, institutions, family office, IFAs, journalists, analysts, and retail investors? A couple of pieces of absolute nuggets to go. You've got to think about these sort of things, individuals.
The audience you mentioned probably may know better than me, but, you know, I think it's just be on point, be nimble and be ready to move when you have to move. You know, you're not going to get it right every time. So I think people talk about, you know, you got to know when to get out, you got to know when to take a profit, which can be hard, and you got to know when to cut a loss. So I think these are the key things. And I think I learned that quite early on, even back in my market making days, because you can be staring at a loss, believing it's going to turn around, and you're like caught like a rabbit in the headlines. So you've got to be, you've got to be quite resolute in your decision making. And when you enter a position or a trade or an investment, you've got to have your parameters. You know, I'm aiming for 5-10%, and if it goes wrong by 2 or 3, I'm getting out. You've got to be ruthless. You know, I mean, that's what's worked for me. You know, don't go chasing profits, and equally don't go chasing losses. You know, and balance your portfolio. You know, equity, debt, long term, short term. You know, it's all there. And look, because of, you know, services like yours and plenty, there's so much information out there. Stick to your knitting, stick to what you know, stick to what you're interested in, and cut your losses. Take your profits at the right time. That's the key to this.
Thank you ever so much. That's pearls of wisdom there from Mike McCudden.
Yeah.
Mike, thank you ever so much. Mike McCudden of Infinitex and JP Jenkins.
Yeah. Thank you. Really nice to meet you,
Peter. Platform.
Yeah.
Been a pleasure.
Absolute pleasure. Yeah. Anytime.
Thank you very much. And
thank
I will
you.
Hopefully get the opportunity to speak to you soon, Mike. Take
All
care
right.
And God bless you.
All right. You too, mate. Thank you. Cheers. Have a good one. Thanks.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to Investing Matters. Be sure to check out the London South East website for free tools and info to research your next investment. You can also join in the conversation on our social media channels. And don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel for more content, including our CEO interviews. Catch you next time.